This is Solo Travel Talk, the Japan series. Your solo travel advisor and host is Astrid Clements.
Japan seems to be a country and a culture that appreciates reflection and beauty. These values come together in a unique way when it comes to the gardens of Japan. Your solo travel advisor, Astrid Clements, loves exploring gardens on her adventures, and what a treat were the gardens she viewed in Japan. I'm producer Catherine O'Brien. One part aesthetics, one part philosophical ideals, Astrid is going to transport us through the magic of podcasting to the spectacular gardens of Japan. I love that podcasts can take us halfway around the world, Astrid.
Well, I'm going to try my best to paint the picture of how wonderful the gardens of Japan are, and that by really taking the time to visit them and to understand what you're experiencing, it does have an effect on you. It had a very strong effect on me.
Well, and also, I just want to, before we get really going here, I do want to put in for our listeners, we know that you love how-tos, so we, in the middle of the show, are going to have a great how-to for you that I can't wait for it to hear Astrid's response. So just so you know, we have a nice how-to right built into the middle of the show, brought to you by the Astrid Travel Club. But Astrid, you are the kind of traveler who makes sure to take in gardens wherever you're traveling. Is that fair to say?
Oh, I love gardens. And you know, I really, I know you had, and when we talked about what we were going to talk or how we were going to create this show, I told you that I really was never like this, a garden lover or into horticulture, because I kill everything I try to plant. I mean, I've always appreciated just anything that's beautiful. I'm like everybody who appreciates something special. But what kind of got me into visiting gardens was a very weird way. Because like I told you, I kill everything that I plant. I'm not one of these people that can visualize how to do something beautiful, you know, and then make it happen and keep it watered. It doesn't work for me. But my husband, who is an architect or is a retired architect, about 25 years ago, maybe longer, was working on a project in New Orleans. It was for the land-based casino. And he didn't want to do a building that just stood out like a casino. His concept was, let's try to soften it. This is going to be at the end of Canal Street. And he wanted to create a garden, basically a park like around it, and then have the building a little bit camouflaged with, I think I remember it correctly, kind of an incline up, and then to have a rooftop garden on the top where you could overlook the Mississippi. And so he was going to try to create a very urban friendly, with landscaping, parks, et cetera, a park to soften this casino. So he said, Astrid, I would like you to research gardens and et cetera, and then give me some feedback, because he really knew nothing about it. But this was kind of his concept. So I started doing all this research, and I was reading about Renaissance gardens and classical Italian and French and Spanish gardens and how they're different, and just the whole history of it and how it blended with their culture and their values and just the psyche of the time. And I really started getting turned on to, you know, just how fabulous gardens were. It was really the thing that stimulated me to start appreciating gardens where I travel. So from that point on, I started making a point to go to a garden or two wherever I was. I went to Giverny, Monet's garden right outside of Paris. That was absolutely enchanting to go to spend a day there and have a real good guide give you a lot of background information about his life and how the garden played into his art. And one of the things that I remember about it is that he was so disciplined. To me, when I think of an artist, I think of somebody who is just kind of like a free spirit, free flowing, kind of tormented to a certain extent, and then finally doing something fabulously, you know, fabulously creative. That wasn't his personality at all. He ate breakfast every day at a certain time. He did this at a certain time. He ate lunch at a certain time. I mean, he was so disciplined. It was unbelievable. And to see how a creative person could be so disciplined and have such a magnificent oasis that he created where he did his art, I just loved it. So if you're in France and say you're in Paris, take the day trip out to Giverny because it is fabulous. Well, that was one of them. And then I went to the Kew Botanical Gardens in London. And I also was there during the Chelsea Flower Show. So I said, well, I'm going to go to the Chelsea Flower Show, see what that was all about. Oh, my gosh. That was an affair. That was fabulous. I mean, they had afternoon tea served and all these gorgeous new hybrid plants and flowers and landscaping designs and contests. And people were dressed up and some were not. It was really something extraordinarily wonderful to do. And it made you appreciate, to me, how beautiful nature is and the type of things that the British like. So that was one thing. And then I went to the Botanical Gardens in Singapore. Now, that's another place. If you go to Singapore, you should definitely take the time and spend probably a little over a half a day because it's large. But this is one of the two UNESCO World Botanical Gardens that have this designation. And it is mind-blowing there. It is gorgeous.
I remember when we did the Singapore episode, you told us about that garden. And it just was like, I couldn't believe it. And then when I went online and saw pictures, it's just stunning. It just only begins to, I can't even imagine what it was like for you to be there.
Oh yeah. It was fabulous. And then other, you know, when I later went to Fontainebleau and Versailles for, you know, probably the fourth time, I paid more attention to the garden. I really did. And same thing in Berlin. My mother's from Berlin. I've been to Sanssouci, which is in Potsdam, right close to Berlin, the big kind of country castle for the former German kings. I can't think exactly the word right now, but this is magnificent. The acres of different types of gardens, etc. And the last time I went, I focused more on the gardens. And I've kind of like evolved that way. So I know I'm going on and on, but I'm trying to basically share with you that, you know, since I've been turned on to the thought and the design and the value of really fabulous gardens all over the world, I have really made the effort to go and visit them. And I must tell you, not only have I enjoyed it so much, and I do think it's made a difference in my travels, it's also made my yard really beautiful because I've come home and now I have a statue and I have different little things that I have seen all over the world. I mean, it makes my own home, to me, 1,000 times better than if I would not have taken the time and seen all these different things and then brought it home into my own life. So that's another little offshoot. And then I think really, if you go to gardens when you're visiting a destination, it gives you a good break from just the normal things that you traditionally do when you go to another city. It's kind of like a respite, but it's not like a waste of time. So that's another thing. You know, you said, I take the time. Yes, I do, because it kind of gives me a break, you know, when I'm traveling. So I've kind of wrapped this question up by a couple of things. First of all, we mentioned Singapore, but I have found that the cities in the world that have the most beautiful gardens are the most fabulous cities. And seriously,
nice little correlation there.
There's a correlation there. I really do think there's a correlation there. Singapore is a prime example. That, in fact, they call Singapore the Garden City, but it, to me, is almost utopia for a city, because as they developed a modern Singapore, they put so much emphasis on green space, on livability in terms of balancing, you know, structures and flowers and plants. And oh, it is, they have all kinds of, they probably have more rooftop gardens than anywhere in the world. There are gardens everywhere, all through the city and all around the buildings and everything. So it makes a tremendous difference. So gardens are becoming, and green spaces are becoming more and more valued by people in their personal lives and when they go and travel. In fact, there's even a new travel niche called garden tourism. And I didn't know that until I kind of researched a few of the things.
Who
I
are
wanted.
That?
Yes. And then, you know, these are specialty trips focused on horticulture or any types of gardens. When I saw this, I said, you know, it's funny how your life unfolds, but I've just created the Astrid Travel Club. And one of the trips in 2020 that we're developing is a trip to London. It'll be about the gardens of London and basically a British culture, but it'll focus on horticulture. And the one of the main events is going to the Chelsea Flower Show. I mean, I think it's almost that I have gravitated to that degree with this. So, yes, Catherine, when I travel, I do take time to visit the gardens.
Now, turning now to Japan, I noticed when I was getting ready for this episode that there are so many things that you've already highlighted in the Japan series up to this point that kind of come together when we're talking about gardens. Shrines are found in gardens. Traditional Japanese aesthetics are found in Japanese gardens. In your Japan trip, how many gardens did you visit? And can you give us kind of an overview of Japanese gardens?
Okay, well, I have to take some time to kind of share some background information, because if I don't do that, then I think that our listeners might totally miss a lot of what Japanese gardens are all about and the value of visiting them. I have to say that I have found, and I would probably have been the same way too, is that many Westerners think, when they think about Japanese gardens, they go, oh, ho-hum, boring. You know, they just are too plain. Because what we are conditioned to is really kind of more of a classical European garden or whatever, where there's a lot of symmetry, it's orderly, clipped shrubs, hedges, flowers, fountains, you know, a lot of, not opulence, but it has a whole different look, okay? And then in Japan, their gardens are meant to express basically peace and tranquility through a natural type of presentation. So, you know, Western gardens, they are done to impress with opulence and some kind of unique, I guess you'd say, a landscape bravado. But Japanese gardens are to soothe the senses. That base right there is the key to the base, okay? Now, Japanese traditional gardens really have their roots in the Japanese Shinto religion. And this religion is an old religion that was kind of evolved out of their agrarian culture that worships and reveres nature. And in traditional Japanese gardens, they avoid any artificial ornamentation. And like I said, they like to highlight the natural landscape. And many of these gardens are also laid out by feng shui principles, which this is just harnessing positive energy with the way you place things, and there's a lot in feng shui. I can't go into it now, but I'm going to read you this quote about a Japanese garden design that kind of Asian or out there on the Asian thinking side, But it does let you understand that these gardens are not just done for certain look. They have a lot more in it. The energy flow through the gardens is all part of how they begin the concept. But this quote says, "It is a good omen to make the stream arrive from the east, to enter the garden, pass under the house, and then leave from the southeast. In this way, the water of the blue dragon will carry away all bad spirits from the house towards the white tiger." So basically, the layout is key to good spiritual energy for the Japanese. I mean, when they talk about, you know, the white tiger, that's basically wisdom and strength and good fortune. And so by having this energy, you know, or this path through it from east to southeast, that in itself is a flow of good energy toward good, and it's protecting you. If you would never heard of anything like this, you wouldn't be thinking about, unless you were into horticulture, how was it laid out east, west, and the, you know, and the paths and this. But this is key. This is very important because they want to keep the kami, which this is the nature gods, happy. Because if the kami are happy, then the people will feel happy when they're there. Now, like Western gardens, Japanese gardens are, their designs are deliberate, okay? Every element, though, is supposed to have some kind of meaning or purpose. And by doing this, it's to help you reflect on your life. When you go into a Japanese garden, it's really like going into somewhat of a sacred space because it's so grounded into nature and how nature helps you with your life in terms of your mental, spiritual, and even just biological health. I know that I'm getting a little out there, and some of what I'm going to say is maybe kind of a little out there, but it's to show you that there's symbolism mm-hmm. in everything, and there's a lot in it. That these aren't ho-hum gardens.
Yeah. We can go out there. I mean, we're saying that there's a philosophical element to these
yes,
gardens.
And, yeah. Yes, and I think you wanted me to answer that, you know, or to bring that.
You know I like going out there.
Okay. But then also the gardens are very much, most of them are designed to adapt to the changes of the seasons, that they're beautiful no matter what the season are. It is. But this is done to help you understand and adapt to the changing nature in your own life. And I think all that is very special, that this is, to me, so important to them. Because when I was in Japan, I can tell you, I had kind of like a breakthrough in my consciousness. And in a lot of things that I didn't know that I needed to deal with or think about. And I think that some of why this happened to me there, because I really was kind of shocked, I wasn't thinking like this at all, is some of these different things that are underpinning in the designs of these gardens. And it's not totally that this happened to me in the gardens. It permeated itself through a lot of the Japanese culture. But the gardens are a reflection of their values, which is so fabulous that they take that so seriously. It's not artificial for just beauty. It is something to really help you thrive in your life and understand your life. Okay. So key design principles of traditional Japanese gardens are they're asymmetrical, totally different than, you know, classical Western, you know, symmetry, balance, even though they like balance, but it deals with asymmetry. They like to also incorporate borrowed scenery, which I thought was very fascinating. I didn't realize that when I was there, but that is that what's like you'll have a garden, but what is outside of the garden, like mountains, hills, even skyscrapers, anything, they design the garden by the principles that they are doing, but they also incorporate the borrowed scenery.
Like a mimicking or like
it's like a frame.
Oh.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yes. And it might be totally different than what's going on in the garden. But it is used, and sometimes it's used to bring in to the garden itself. And then, like I said, lots of symbolism in these gardens. So the key overall classic design concept of a Japanese garden is really the more natural and harmonious the garden's design, the more conducive it is for contemplation. And this contemplation or this conduciveness to this state is to help you stay on your natural path of life, which I thought that was just beautiful, because they believe you need to find your unique path to your life's meaning. And basically, you can't force your path. It must come naturally. So these gardens are designed to have a flow in them that help you get in sync with your own life and to think about it. So the design, basically, and the aesthetics of Japanese gardens have meaning. And like I said, they're catalysts for reflection and enlightenment. I read a couple of little things of examples of how they do this intentionally is, say you have a stone path that you have to walk through. Well, when you walk on a stone path, you have to pay attention, because if you don't, you might fall in the water or, you know, twist your ankle. I mean, you have to be careful, but that is making you slow down, and that is making you pay attention to the little things or the details. And then some say you have a large path, and this is you walk easily down there and you notice really what's around you, or the broader vision, like the big picture versus the little picture. And that's all part of what's in there. And if you would never think about that, but even if you know it and you think about it and you don't think that it's done, it's made you think, oh, well, I better pay attention to always brushing my teeth or something like that 3 times a day. But even if it wouldn't stimulate an exact thought at that time, the exercise of all of that does work on your whole physical and mental psyche together. So there's lots of things in these gardens. Then there's a garden style called the stroll style. And this is usually a path that's around typically a pond. But by walking on this path, it's supposed to stimulate appreciating your blessings and what's in front of you at the moment. It's basically to help you be grateful and to focus on the now. And they believe that is one of the secrets to happiness. Mm. Don't worry about the past. Don't worry about the future. Yeah, but focus very much on the now. And the Japanese are, I found them to be very skilled at that. And that might be some of the secret to how great their economy is and really how full and wonderful their culture is. I was like completely blown away, because I felt like the Japanese were going to be much more similar to other Asian cultures. And I found some similarities, but not as many as I thought. So these gardens and this stroll garden is kind of, you know, those paths are to help you get into the now, okay? As well as to show you that life's purpose takes time, that it's not a straight line. And it's not the shortest route. And it's not like, as we think in the West, goal setting, accomplishments, to-do list, all that. No, life's purpose will unfold naturally in time. So these gardens, the way that they're designed, are to stimulate that kind of palette of reality to help you get these kinds of principles down and to help you with your life.
You know what I just flashed on, Astrid, is
what?
Your experience with labyrinths.
Yes.
Is there, do you find that there's an overlap there?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. But the labyrinth is more like a mathematical, spiritual kind of, I want to say it is rooted in some kind of incredible spiritual, I want to say consciousness that created that form. And by walking it, the times that I've done it, I've had some very strong spiritual breakthroughs a couple of days afterwards. And I really wasn't looking for that, but I wanted to go and do it because I had read about this lady that I was really fascinated by from San Francisco. She felt that labyrinths were very healing and they were good to do to help you kind of find your path in life. So it's similar, but to me, I felt like it was a mathematical kind of spiritual construct where this is more based into nature and it maybe it's a Eastern consciousness, but it might have some similarities.
Maybe,
I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, it both of them made me or brought me to breakthroughs. And I really wasn't expecting that at all because I'm a very opinionated person and it takes a lot for me to feel like I didn't know something or whatever. And I don't mean to sound kind of, you know it all, but I've lived a lot and et cetera. And I'm always eyes wide open. The Japanese gardens I found to be very comforting, like the labyrinth I didn't, but the gardens, oh yeah, they were just, ooh.
So we'll put that down as like there's a small relationship, but maybe not completely.
Yeah. Okay. Well, then the next thing I was going to say is the Japanese garden designs avoid straight lines. Mm. They're not natural. They like free form. So see, the labyrinth isn't free formed. It doesn't have any straight lines, but you know, but it's not free form. Another thing that they do that I thought was so odd is they like to prune the plants and the trees, like say the bonsais and all that, to slow the growth down because they feel that age makes plants grow into better shapes. And I mean, my husband, well, he likes to get out in the garden and prune. And every time he starts pruning, I'm saying, you're going to kill it. You're going to kill it. He said, no, Astrid, it makes it come back better. And he's so right. I mean, the Japanese do it. But here again, this pruning is kind of like a focus on that the beauty of aging and perfection is the essence of human nature, that we ourselves have to be pruned and cut back. Like I said, I was just blown away when I was learning all this. And just like when I was blown away and did that research for my husband for that casino and how he's going to try to camouflage it in a nice way. But there's so much to it. And it does do what it's designed to do. At least I felt it. So a little bit more about symbolism in Japanese gardens, like the flowering trees, the cherry blossom trees especially. And I was so lucky. I went to Japan and the cherry blossoms just hit the season exactly right. But that makes everybody so excited because, first of all, it's the symbol of youth, rebirth, everything. And most people feel like spring is that way. But the Japanese, I mean, anything flowering trees, they just go, oh, you know, I mean, it's like life is starting anew. And then the autumn leaves, though, is the passing of time. Basically, the change is inevitable. And each season, they believe, is unique and beautiful. So humans should not resist change, but they should adapt to change. I guess I'm philosophizing now, but I think that's so cool. A lot of us are just so, I guess you'd say, set in our ways or trying not to be, but it's hard to change. It's hard to feel okay about change, you know, especially if it came too strong, too quickly. But these gardens are designed to help you embrace the change, and that knowing that there's always going to be something good in whatever. It just takes time to see it. And another thing, I found that this is my little mind thinking. I found that the Japanese gardens were really like the people. They were peaceful. They were quiet. They were very dignified, spotlessly clean, orderly, and restrained. I mean, I got that kind of epiphany. I said, these gardens are just like the way the people are. I guess you'd say one can live his or her life similar, I guess you'd say, to the design of the Japanese garden. You discover it, you don't force it, and your life unfolds. I hope this wasn't too heady.
No, I like it.
Or philosophical for our listener. But I think everybody who visits a Japanese garden should be familiar with these design basics and their symbolism. I really do. And before we go on to the next one, I think I would be remiss if I didn't mention this one thing. There are 5 basic types of garden designs. Okay. Yeah. So if you go to Japan, you should be aware of this, because if you want to visit gardens, you want to know whether this is this kind of garden or that kind of garden. But the 5 basic gardens are the dry landscape garden, the study garden, the strolling garden that I mentioned, the tea garden, and then the courtyard garden. So these are the classic 5 types of gardens. And like the dry landscape garden is the Zen garden that, you know, I guess Japan is most or best known for, and I guess you'd say least understood by non-Japanese cultures. Because I can tell you, I'm still struggling with appreciating the dry landscape garden. But these are gardens with no water in it, no real water. And all other Japanese gardens have to have water, and they like flowing streams, etc. In these gardens, they have, you know, stone, rocks, boulders, gravel. The gravel is the symbol of water or the dry river or ocean. And when you see them rake it in these, this is the symbol, this is the water symbol in there. And then you have these large rocks and boulders and smaller rocks put together in different kind of groups or non-groups. This all, you know, this refers to mountains or hills or something that is not water. And really, Japan, I did a whole a series on food and eating something from the land and the sea. They are so basic in these 2 things, and every meal you have to have that. And this garden is basically the utmost basic thought of what Japan feels the life source, some of the life source comes from. They might have some trees in this, but it's usually around it, and that's kind of a symbol for endurance. But these gardens are really for contemplation and meditation. These are the purest of the contemplation gardens. And in fact, the monks used to practice, I mean, they were kind of supposedly created by the monks, but there's a little controversy on how they came to pass. But the monks like these types of gardens. But they're supposed to stimulate, you know, when things go wrong in your life, there's a meaning in this situation. And that as a person who's wise, you should be flexible to begin with. Don't just panic or say no or going to fight it. Just first of all, be flexible and adjust your attitude. And keep asking yourself, what am I to be learned for this? That's not easy for the Western mind or how we've been educated to think, you know, we're always looking at, well, where was the fault of this or whatever. But we don't look at what's the meaning of this situation and how are we going to learn from it. We don't do that first. We want to solve it or protect ourselves or whatever. But these gardens are supposed to get you into a real reflective kind of consciousness about, you know, say something bad that's happened to you, whether you was self-inflicted or not. But I would venture to say that most non-Japanese visitors to dry landscape Zen gardens wouldn't have a clue about the symbolism in this garden design and what it reflects and projects to the visitor. They just go in there and say, okay, I've seen it, been there, done that, real fast. And I have to admit, I'm probably one that would have that same kind of struggle, but I'm going to work on it because, you know, I don't think this is baloney. I really don't. I think this is something very basic. We'll have to see. But so that's the background on dry landscape gardens. So when you go, just know they're for deep contemplation and meditation. Now, the next garden, real quick, is a study garden. And this is one of the oldest types that are still common today. And these are gardens that are not designed to walk around in. They're designed just to stand in front of and study like you would study like a painting. And they usually have like a pond and inclined of all the plants and everything around it. And they'll have some lanterns and maybe a pagoda and statuary throughout. And, you know, of course, the bridges, et cetera. But it's not meant for you to enter into it. It's just meant for you to stand and study it. Okay, the next garden is the strolling garden. And that was what I told you about. This was very popular and kind of developed in the Edo period when they had the shoguns and the feudal and the samurai, which were called daimyo, I think. And sometimes these gardens are called daimyo gardens, but they're the beautiful. I mean, they're very peaceful, curved hills, walking paths, usually, you know, arranged around a lake with the bridges. And these types of gardens most of the time were, like I said, created by these powerful, wealthy lords. And they went there to have parties and to do their own reflection, write poetry, you know, sail around the pond. I read they even go out and do, you know, view the moon. I didn't get what this was all about. But these gardens were really like a Shangri-La for the samurai and the elite. The next one is a tea garden. Now, these are gardens that are always connected to tea houses. And these gardens really are an integral part of the tea ceremony because it helps the person or the guest to prepare for the tea ceremony. And how they're designed is basically walking through the garden to the tea room is to purify the guest before the ceremony, or basically to get you in the right mindset to participate and to really get the most out of the tea ceremony. And the tea ceremony, we should do a whole podcast on the tea ceremony. Oh, okay. Oh, there's so much into that. And, you know, as a Westerner, you might think, oh, well, that was kind of that nice, you know, it was different. But there's so much more into just, I mean, every movement of the person making the tea and there's a whole consciousness of just anybody in the ceremony is supposed to be all in the same level. There's all kinds of things there. But in the tea gardens are to get you in the right mindset to partake in the ceremony. And they usually don't have any flowering plants. It's usually all evergreen, which I thought that was interesting too. And the last one is most people won't see these unless you go into a traditional Japanese ryokan or a home or whatever. But these are courtyard gardens within the structure, the residence, or it could be a combination of where they do their business and live. But they have these little gardens inside, maybe one, two, could be three. And they all have some kind of water feature with, you know, kind of like that little bamboo fountain thing. I saw it several times. But it's not only for reflection and kind of creating good chi or like that feng shui again. It helps with the airflow, too, in terms of cooling. In the Japanese houses. So, you know, it's not just for, I guess, a spiritual or, you know, some kind of fun. It has really an architectural kind of quality of life.
It's like form and function at the same time, beauty and functionality.
Correct. Yes. So, okay. Now, I know this answer was a much more than top level overview of Japanese.
Oh, I think that's exactly what we were looking for.
Garden. But I really did feel that I had to go into this kind of detail to enlighten or to share about what Japanese gardens, you know, are about and how to appreciate enjoying them. And with Japanese gardens are not boring. They're fascinating.
Yeah. Well, and it did seem like the whole reason I wanted to ask that question is because it did seem like the gardens were a culmination of some of the things you've been highlighting along the way.
They were. They really were. And I didn't realize how much they're a catalyst to understanding a lot of the Zen beliefs and the philosophical beliefs and disciplines that the Japanese just naturally do.
Interesting. Well, let's take a little break here. We have a special question for you, Astrid, that's brought to you by the Astrid Travel Club.
Yeah. I was going to say yes and join.
So yeah, we've talked a little bit about the Astrid Travel Club. We have a whole episode that's dedicated to the Astrid Travel Club. If you are in this sort of the same mindset that we're talking about, those mindful travelers, the Astrid Travel Club might be perfect for you. And we have a little question here for you, Astrid. Gardens can be a feature really of any solo travel trip. What is your best tip for visiting gardens, no matter where you are in the world?
Okay, the first part of my best tip for visiting gardens when traveling solo is to just do it. Like museums, many solo travelers will skip visiting gardens because basically they don't think it's time well spent or it's valuable or really is that stimulating. But I really beg to differ, just like in Japan. You know, you might think, oh, those gardens are, you know, you see one, you see them all, but it's not that way. Visiting gardens in any particular travel destination will definitely give you an added understanding of the place's culture. Mm. Everywhere you go has a different climate, a different topography, architecture. This is all unique to those places. But also the gardens and the parks that flourish in a particular place are also reflections of what the people and their culture enjoy and value. Just like I went into all of that information about Japanese gardens. I mean, it goes into their philosophical beliefs and how it helps them with their life. So the first part of the tip is decide to visit a garden or two when you travel. Just put that on the itinerary. And the second part of the trip is to know before you go. Basically, do some pre-trip research. Figure out or if there's any notable gardens to visit and what they're noted for. Like I mentioned, the Singapore Botanical Gardens. If you go to Singapore, you have to go to that, in my opinion. You'll really be missing something wonderful if you don't. Also, London, the Kew Gardens in London, they're fabulous. They're worth taking the time to go and spend a half a day or maybe in the afternoon tea there, and it's quintessentially English. Then also, you know, you might see some private gardens or secret gardens or whatever in places where you're thinking about going. If that's kind of what you think you'd be or like to go see, put that on your itinerary. Now, if you start to really feel yourself getting pulled in and you really think this is cool, there are even garden day tours now in a lot of cities. This garden tourism is becoming more and more important. And maybe it's because more and more people are so heavily dependent on technology and they're seeking nature as a balance, you know, through hiking and a lot of outdoor activities, just being outside and in nature. That might be some of why this is happening too, Catherine. But the second part is to decide which ones are important, okay? I can tell you, if you don't prioritize visiting gardens when you travel, you're probably not going to do it. It's just one of those things that will, you'll just say, oh, well, you know, that wasn't a priority. But to me, you need to make that a priority. And then last, you know, visiting parks and gardens, it's a great way, I think, to change the pace and the focus of your itinerary. You know, it just kind of breaks up sightseeing. And it's a lot less dangerous than shopping. It's true. You're not going to spend any money on what do they call those purchases?
Impulse buys.
Impulse buys. Yeah.
It's a little harder to do an impulse buy there. That's great. Well, this how to bring some garden viewing into your trip, your solo travel adventure, has been brought to you by the Astrid Travel Club. Astrid, how do people find out more about the Astrid Travel Club?
Well, the best way is just to go to my website, astridtravel.com, and you'll see at the front or at the top footer header, there's the Astrid Travel Club. So just click on that, and then you go down to the little drop down, and you can figure it out.
Yeah, and you go from there. And also, I will include a link in the show notes, so you can click through there on any of your podcast players, and you can go and explore and see if the Astrid Travel Club is right for you. We'd love to see you over there.
I think you're going to like what you see with the club. We put a lot of thought into it, and the trips that we're coming up with are great. And, you know, when you join, you get a wonderful travel journal that we've put together. What we did with this journal is we tried to help you get the right mindset before you go on your trips or your travels. And we put together 15 questions that, you know, I many times ask myself or go through most of these questions to kind of help me prepare for the trip and to get into what I'm going to be experiencing. And so I can get the most out of it and I can keep those lessons and those memories alive. So I think we've done a great job with this.
I love
them. Yeah. In fact, we're going to do a whole podcast on travel mindset in journaling, and I'm going to use my journal or the journal that you get as the basis of the show.
I think that's a great idea. Let's turn back to Japan now, and we'll start closing out the show by saying, what are the must-see gardens for Japan?
Oh.
Is that an impossible question?
Let me tell you something. There must be hundreds of thousands of gardens in Japan. I mean, they love their gardens, so there are gardens everywhere. I mean, there's so many fabulous that it's pitiful to try to say the top five is like pathetic.
Okay, so we'll go into it knowing that there's
But as any solo traveler traveling to Japan, you have to, like I said, prioritize which gardens you want to see. Because if you try to do too many, it's gonna become a blur, and you're gonna be gardened out. You probably will just sit there and decide, well, I'm not gonna do anything else. I mean, they're kind of powerful to basically. So, okay, well, choose your gardens carefully, and then in the ones that you plan to visit, spend plenty of time there, so you can really let everything sink in. And I would say try to get a sampling of a couple of the different types. So for my particular trip to Japan, I targeted only a few, Catherine, for my itinerary because I had so many other must-dos, and this was my first trip to Japan. So I'm going to give you the ones that I went to, and then I'm going to also give you the ones that are touted as the most fabulous in Japan that I didn't get to go to. Okay, so the first one was actually in my hotel. And I chose my hotel, the Hotel New Otani, because it was one of the few hotels in Tokyo that had a Japanese garden. And I couldn't believe what I was reading when I was deciding whether I should stay here or this other hotel. But this particular hotel has a 400-year-old garden that was originally owned and designed by a samurai. And it was purchased after the Meiji period, I can't remember exactly, by Mr. Otani. So he kept the garden and enlarged it and made it fabulous. I mean, it's 10 acres with a gorgeous pond, waterfall, scarlet bridges, you know, koi fish in the pond, super old trees that are over 1,000 years old that they have pruned and kept, and it's amazing. A stone garden that has one of the largest boulders of some kind of stone that's rare in Japan, which is supposed to be very auspicious, as well as beautiful tea houses in there. So this garden is magnificent. I mean, I saw pictures of it, and it was the key thing that made me end up deciding to stay at this hotel, and it blew me away. It was even better than I thought it was going to be. And what my thinking was is that I won't be able to do too many gardens, but if I have a wonderful garden at my hotel that I can come to in the evening and sit in, or I can stroll through after breakfast or whatever, that I will get at least some kind of feel for Japanese gardens, etc. Well, let me tell you, it was fabulous. And also one of the things that was written about it, TripAdvisor touts it extremely high. Plus, it's supposed to be one of the top 20 best free attractions in Japan. I mean, this garden at this hotel is stunning. So that was my first garden. Okay, the second one that I recommend is in Kyoto, and it is outside of Kyoto in Arashiyama, and this is where the famous bamboo forest is, and anybody going to Kyoto should spend a day in Arashiyama. Well, there they have this beautiful temple called Tenryu Yuji Temple and Garden. The temple is beautiful. It's called the Temple of the Heavenly Dragon. Mm. But the gardens are, and I went during cherry blossom season. And this is like a movie set. They have all these little paths that go around and different little small ponds and, you know, flowering trees at that time. But I can't really describe it. It's like being in an enchanted place around this temple. And then after that, you can walk right into the bamboo forest. It's right connected to it. And if you walk through the different paths in this forest, it leads you to more shrines and more ponds and different things in there. It spend a whole day in the Arashiyama area. And if you do, you will go to this temple and garden because it's a key. So that was one that I visited, and, you know, this should be on your to-do list. Because you get temple, you get gardens, and you get the bamboo forest, and you really get the whole kind of feel for spiritual thoughts and being spiritual in nature.
Like a sampler. It's like a little...
Yes, it is. It is. Okay. Then the next one is a strolling garden. And this one is also near Kyoto. It's the Kinkakuji Temple and Gardens. And it's one of the most... Well, this temple itself is one of the most famous in Japan because it's three stories, and the top two stories are completely covered with gold gilding.
Oh, yeah.
So this gold it looks like a piece of china or a huge piece of, you know, china ware or something. It's just so mind-boggling, but it's beautiful. It's very serene. It's not opulent. It has opulence to it, but it's not off-putting. Well, in this garden, it's at the back, kind of in the middle of this pond. And so the path strolls all the way around the pond and the temple. So you get different angles of this gorgeous temple always reflecting in the lake. You can take fabulous photos there. And then in this garden, it has all of the rocks and the trees and the stone elements and the koi and the pond and everything. It has all of the elements that are in Japanese garden design. But you have this stunning focal point of this temple, which is a spiritual focal point in I guess you would say stimulant. It's beautiful. It was really beautiful. The only problem with going there, and I have to share this with you, is you need to try to go there either first thing or the last, because there are lots of people there. Everybody tries to see this when they come to Japan.
So I was wondering about crowds.
Some of it. Okay. Then the next one, which was so ironic to me, Catherine, the last thing that I did on my 3.5-week trip in Japan was visit a garden. I thought that was so, not funny, but just kind of, I guess it was meant to be. But this was in Hiroshima at the Sukiyen Garden. And I specifically wanted to go to this garden. And I almost missed it, but I ended up having enough time. And I got there kind of late at 3:30. So I had to rush a little bit, which, you know, I could have spent 4 hours there. But I wanted to go there because, you know, Hiroshima is where they had the atom bomb. And this whole area where this garden was in downtown Hiroshima was completely obliterated. So I was curious to see, you know, what kind of garden that they had done now, because I had been all through the Peace Park, etc. But I wanted to see, I guess I just wanted to see if it grew right and what it was like and what they created there. Well, let me tell you, I thought it was the best garden that I went to the whole trip because, it's called the Garden of Shrunken Sceneries, but what it is a lot of miniature scenes of Japan around this lake. So they have miniature, like little valleys and hills and some streams and rivers and waterfalls, rice fields, bamboo garden. I mean, it's like they took all of Japan and the various parts of their nature and their natural, and they put all those different plants and trees, and they did it in a way that it was wonderful to walk on. You had some of these little stone paths that you had to be really careful. And then these big wide paths, the tea houses. It was totally enchanting. I mean, I was so upset when, you know, they closed the door at 5 o'clock and I had to leave. And I read some of the reviews when I came back home of that. And everybody said, if you go to Hiroshima, you must go to these gardens because it blew them away.
Wow.
Yeah, it's something that you would think, oh, well, they'll probably be okay. These were, I mean, I thought it was the best out of all the gardens that I saw, to include those famous ones. Okay, so those are the ones that I visited. But I have to go back and share the other ones that everybody talks about because I'll feel like I'm not doing the question justice. So the first one is, these are the top three gardens in Japan that anybody who writes about gardens or who's a garden, Japanese garden expert, they say these are the top three. Mm. Number one is the Kenrokuen in Kanazawa. And this is supposed to, well, it's a strolling garden, first of all. And you need to really have probably at least a day and a, you know, a half a day and plus to enjoy it. And you have to basically, it's in Kanazawa. And so you have to take the train there because really, this is probably the best thing or the only reason why you'd go to Kanazawa. Okay. But it's supposed to be fabulous in all seasons and especially in winter. They talk about how fabulous this garden is in winter, but it has wonderful scenic views and ponds and hills, pavilions. It has everything that I've been talking about, but it's supposed to be the best. Okay. The next one is the Kurakuen in Okayama, and it is called the Garden of Pleasure. And this garden was based on a Confucius proverb that the rulers should consider the needs of their subjects first and find his own pleasure afterwards. So I guess what this is all about is this garden was created for the people, not for the elite, which it is highly touted. It is supposed to be just gorgeous. The next one is one of those dry landscape Zen gardens. It's at the Ryoanji Temple in Kyoto, but it's the most famous rock garden in Japan. And it only has 15 stones in it with all the pebbles, and it's enclosed, and it's not very big at all. And so there's no plants there. There's a little bit of moss on the stones, and the Japanese love moss. But if you want to see the best or most famous rock garden, this is it. Okay, so those are the top three. So you've got a strolling garden, you've got a pleasure garden or garden, and then you have the dry landscape garden. Then there's a study garden that is very highly touted is the Adachi. It's at the Adachi Museum of Art in Matsue, which is about 3 hours from Osaka. So see, you'd probably have to take the bullet train there and spend the day there. But this museum is supposed to be outstanding. And this garden has won awards every year as the best garden in Japan, as far as study garden. And basically here it is, like you view it like a painting. So the whole concept is you go into the museum and see paintings, and then you go outside and the garden is a painting. Yeah. Oh, no, it's supposed to be fabulous. That's why I'm mentioning it. Then a tea garden that's highly recommended is the Hamarikyu Onshitien in Tokyo. I just don't know.
Our listeners have already given you a blank slate on the pronunciations. We've already explained this. Yeah.
Let me try it again. Hamarikyu Onshitien in Tokyo.
Listeners, I try to put all the links in the show notes.
Okay. But this was once the hunting ground for Tokiyawa clan. You know, he was one of the biggest shoguns. But this is a tea garden, and it has a real traditional Japanese tea house, and you can go and have tea and have the matcha and the sweets. And this is yearly the scene for the annual Tokyo Grand Tea Ceremony. So this is really one of the best tea gardens in Japan, and it's in Tokyo. So, you know, you can do it if you only go to Tokyo. That would be one good garden for you to go to.
Yeah.
And make sure you stay at the Hotel New Otani. But I'm going to kind of wrap all this up with a couple of things. So as you see, I'm struggling somewhat, but there was a Japanese garden designer by the name of Koichi Kawana. And he said, a Japanese garden cannot be fully explained in words, but must be experienced. And I think that's the bottom line of this show. You have to experience it. And when you do, the more you do, I think some of the things that I've said, it will begin to manifest themselves. And for garden lovers, you know, if you really do love gardens and you want to go to Japan and you want to go see the gardens, you know, of Japan, all Japan tours, AJT, offer excellent garden tours.
Oh, cool.
In all different seasons, they have a great 14-day tour in the fall of this year. So that would be one way to make sure that you visit all the important Japanese gardens and you have expert guides who can make your garden experience really come alive. And really, well, it sounds bizarre to me that I would be saying this, but I mean it. I might even take one of these tours because I was so turned on by these gardens. Yeah. I mean, you really are in a high state of evolution, in my opinion. If you can really experience and get in sync with being in Japanese gardens, I mean, you have let go of a lot of stuff that probably wasn't good for you. And it's such a release. Your happiness just comes more freely to you. It's not a striving. It's just kind of like it flows out of you much, much more naturally. So, Catherine, that's the show for today. Like I said, I hope I've done a good job with this because I tried to bottom line it, but also give you some, you know, symbolism and how they think about this and how they were put together and everything. But, you know, I do hope I've done a fairly decent job in enlightening our our listeners to the value of visiting various types of gardens when you travel solo to Japan. One of the biggest pluses, I think, in traveling solo is you can experience a destination on a deep level because you aren't distracted by other traveling companions. This gives you the opportunity for some quality me time, basically. And having the luxury of being able to experience Japanese gardens solo fosters many enriching and personally enlightening moments. The gardens of Japan were a key factor in my most memorable first trip to this fascinating country. With that said, if you've enjoyed the show or found it informative, give us a thumbs up and a share. We love those thumbs up. Then also let us know what you're thinking in the comment section below. If you have any questions or maybe, you know, I didn't make sense on this, that, and the other. You know, we like comments because when we hear the comments, that helps us just get better at doing this podcast. And last, and certainly not least, is subscribe. This is very important to us because when you subscribe, it broadens our audience exposure around the world. Thanks for listening.
Astrid, what I'm really taking away from this is I loved your tip about using a garden visit on a solo travel adventure as a reset and a way to really kind of, you're doing something, but you're also getting grounded and breaking yourself from the rest of what you're doing. I love that one.
You don't discover it unless if you set it as a thing to do in your agenda, because most of the times you're not taken there.
Yeah.
If you're doing tours or even if you're doing your own itineraries, you just skip it.
Yeah. And we're saying, don't skip it.
Yeah, just do it.
Just do it. Well, thank you so much for listening, everybody. Don't forget, if you need to go over to astridtravel.com and click the Astrid Travel Club and see if the Astrid Travel Club is right for you. This podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify. We love Spotify. Any podcast application, you will be able to find this show. Just search Solo Travel Talk and we do invite you to subscribe because that does help everybody see the show and puts it out there. We're so happy to be back with this Japan series and we look forward to seeing you next time on Solo Travel Talk. Thanks everyone. Goodbye.
Find Astrid on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. All things Astrid, including the Astrid Travel Club and this podcast, are available at astridtravel.com. Thank you for listening to Solo Travel Talk.